Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. First and foremost, thanks so much to everyone who listens, rates, reviews, subscribes, tells people, all that sort of jazz. I mean, in all the different podcasts you listen to, you know the drill. And there's other podcast hosts. They do a far better job than I do in terms of the script or just hitting the main points when it comes to trying to sell the pod. I'm bad at it. I might be loud and an extrovert, but I'm a horrible self-promoter. So I've got a two-parter coming out. And the reason it's two parts is it went a little bit too long to make it in an hour or less. Smarter people know how to release a podcast that's over an hour. But the system that I use, it has to be under an hour. Anyway, you know what? I've already said too much. So it is with the good people of Kennekop, one of the most famous wineries in South Africa in the Stellenbosch region. And the first interview you're going to hear is with the winemaker, Aubrey Bislar. I'm sure I mispronounced his name here. I bet I did it when I was talking to him. By the way, a shout out to all the people I've interviewed who have put up with just me mangling their names in horrible ways. Everyone is so polite. They could easily just yell into the Zoom, "No, you've got it wrong, so terribly wrong." Anyway, so my interview with the winemaker, and just, I mean, this guy's won every award that you could ever imagine, internationally acclaimed winemaker. And then afterwards, I talk with Heidi Kritzinger. And I know I've mispronounced that. It's a heavy more on the dramatic, on the final syllables of her last name. And Heidi is one of the nicest women in wine I have ever met. And when we were there in South Africa, we met with Aubrey, and he gave us a tour of the winery. And the cool thing was the equipment on one half of down in the cellar, there was all the vats set up for just traditional punch downs where, you know, just you have humans with the large sticks and they're punching down on the wine cap, keeping things, you know, just circulating and just giving that wine more life, more power, more body, all that kind of stuff. And then 6 feet away from that was the mechanical punch downs as well. So they have all the technology of today and the future, and right next to it, something you would have seen 100 years ago being done by monks in Burgundy. And, you know, Aubrey would combine the two wines together, the blends, and it was really cool. So it was a really great tour of Kennekop. And then the person who took over was Heidi, and she's sort of in charge of almost everything else, of the money, of dealing with press, of dealing with media, international media, talking to everyone, and really one of the faces of Kennekop. And she was incredible and super nice and buoyant and so much energy. And the main thing I took from her, and you'll hear it in the second interview, was the amount of pride that she had for this winery, working for it. It really felt like, even though she doesn't own it and Aubrey doesn't own it, it really feels like a family winery in terms of how the winery treats all the employees and how the employees feel a sense of ownership right back. It was super, super cool. So without further ado, part one with the winemaker of Kennekop, Aubrey, and then the second part with a force of nature who also with Heidi has participated and won many, many like wine tasting challenges. So she is definitely a force of nature. But without further ado, here is the winemaker, Aubrey Bislar.
The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And for this one, I am going back to South Africa. I'm going back to Stellenbosch, the head winemaker for Kennekop. It is Aubrey Bislar. Aubrey, thank you so much for being a part of this today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so we'll get in. And for people who don't know, this man has won many, many awards. It's, sort of like a Daniel Day-Lewis of wine. But I want to go back a little bit. How rare is your story for your path to become a winemaker? I read you initially
we're interested in medicine and your family has zero background in wine. That's not the normal path for winemakers.
Yeah, it's not indeed. I think, you know, when I started studying at Stellenbosch University, my aim was to become a doctor. And then when I applied, there was a couple of my marks weren't good enough to get into medicine school. And they said, do you go study a BSc agriculture degree, which is the closest to medicine, actually, strange enough. And within my first year, I actually realized, that I could taste wine and describe wine differently than some of my classmates. And that's where I got hooked. And today, I think I strongly believe that everybody has a certain path that they need to follow or supposed to follow. And mine just led to wine. And today I think it just ticks so much more boxes than something like medicine would have. And I'm very grateful that I fell upon this path. And today still, it's a lifestyle rather than a job and enjoying every moment.
What was your family's reaction when you said, hey, I'm not going to be a doctor, I'm going to get into wine?
Yeah, my mom wasn't all that excited about it. And my dad thought it was cool, but my mom said, no, listen, are you sure? And, don't you think there's something else you should rather do? And I think at the end of the day, they're all very happy. And they just saw that it makes me happy. And I think that's the most important thing. So, I think because we didn't come from a wine background, it was a bit strange. Always we had wine in the house and drank wine at home, but it was never considered to be a career. So after a while, they saw, this is something I really enjoy, and it just supported me from then.
What were those moments like? Do you remember when in school and stuff, when you started tasting and you could start to pick out the nuances of it more than the people around you? Do you remember what those days were like? That must have been just an interesting discovery.
It was quite strange because, I at that point, I didn't have any formal education around wine, and sitting in the class and using descriptors that none of my classmates used. And it just like dawned on me that perhaps my sensory, development was different from somebody else's. It was something that made me think that I need to, look into this. It happened by chance, really, than anything else. And it made me excited that I could pick up certain descriptors in wine that other people couldn't. Until today, I think all of us, is so unique in how we perceive aromatics, structure in wine, on a palate. So it is very specific to everybody. And over the years, you realize that and you're just very lucky to a certain extent that your palate and what you appreciate, is similar to the majority of the market, because you get people with very specific tastes and very specific preferences, and perhaps that just covers a small part of the market. And I think when you look at Kanonkop today and the success we had, it's partly due to a style that the majority of the market do appreciate.
And we'll get there, because I'm always curious about any winery, what they're, and there's no one style, obviously. You'd never want to do generalizations, but we'll get into the style of the wines that you make. But first, when you talk about what you do at Kanonkop, you can't not talk about Pinotage. How did you first fall in love with this grape?
So my previous job was at a big cooperative called Swartland Winery. And there I got introduced to Pinotage on a big scale. We make thousands of tons of Pinotage every year. And also from, quite a different area, low yielding, highly concentrated fruit. And there I worked with everything from Cabernet, Merlot, Shiraz, all the normal, more popular varietals. Pinotage is always more of a challenge. The other varietals, it's almost just seemed much easier to make. It was easier to make. And you know, when it came to Pinot Noir, I really saw a challenge in the varietal. And for me, that is something always that excites me. And trying to understand why it's so different and how you can manipulate it to make something great. I think that was, you know, the first introduction of Pinot Noir that really made me lean towards this variety as more than other varieties. You know, except for loving to drink the wine, I think the love is also in the making of it.
And we'll get into the ones that you make here and also just the preconceived notions of it. But take me back to when you became, I think it was like 2003, when you took over as the winemaker. I believe you weren't even 30 at the time, and now you were the head maker of Kennekop. That must have been, wild just at that young age.
Yeah, I think firstly, you know, just to run you through the whole process, I was at that stage working at Swartland Winery. I was making about 1,000 tons of Pinotage for Bayer Strutter. That was a winemaker from Longkopen. And he exported that wine to Tesco and Sainsbury's in the UK under Bayer Strutter's signature wine. So I was actually helping him with that wine at Swartland Winery. And then in that was 1998. Until 2001, and in that time we got to know each other well, and we went on a trip in 2001. We went to a trip to France with a couple of other friends, and during that trip, you know, we really started to connect even more. And on the way back, he asked me if I would join him at Canonical. So for me, it took me about 2 weeks just to get my head around it. Because at that point, I was red winemaker at Swartland, doing about 7,000-8,000 tons of red. And now at that point, Canonkop was doing about 300 tons of red. And it was an assistant winemaker post in 2002. So at a young age, you see, you know, you're taking a step back rather than a step forward. And it took me a couple of weeks just to get my head around it. And once I decided on moving to Canonkop was for the opportunity to work with Bayer. That was the main decision. And also being exposed to wine in a different way and in a different level compared to what I did at Swartland. And that meaning, you know, having more time for the detail attention that you don't always have at a big winery. I always say, you know, the logistics is actually the kick you get out of the making, and the smaller winery is actually, you know, having time to spend on the detail. And so when I decided to come to Canonkop, I didn't know what my salary was going to be. You know, the first time I saw what I was going to earn was the end of the month, and they paid me something. And until today, I don't have a contract at Canonkop. There's no piece of paper saying that I'm working here.
Really?
So it was just a decision that was supposed to happen and it worked out at the end of the day. But like I said, I made it for the right reasons that I wanted to work with Bayer's at that point. That was, a very well renowned winemaker throughout the world. And there was a load of knowledge that I could tap into. And that's how I got started at Canonkop. And yeah, it was, you know, drop your head, grind, and just do your best. That was my approach, and work harder than anybody else around me. And those days, we were putting in 21 hours a day, you know, without a problem. That's how we worked.
So 21 hours a day, smaller winery as the assistant winemaker after leaving the big giant company as the head winemaker. So I think it's fair to say, Aubrey, this was a bit of a leap of faith.
Yeah, you're right. It was a leap of faith. At the end of the day, if you ask me, why did you go? I would say, I'm not sure why, but I think Bayer's played a big role in why I was attracted to this job.
How different of a winemaker are you now? I always like asking winemakers this. How different are you in 2022 than, say, when you finally became the head winemaker almost 2 decades ago at Canonkop?
2 decades ago, my winemaking was based on doing the basics extremely well. doing everything within my knowledge as well as I could, and not leaving room for any mistakes whatsoever. So today I'm the same winemaker with the same approach, but only I do have the, I can also interpret vintages, I can also interpret conditions I couldn't at that point. So I have the same approach on how I want to make wine, attention to detail and zero tolerance for mistakes. Also, I've got the knowledge that I build up over the years, I can now use to interpret and make better decisions in the cellar when it comes to in the vineyard, when to pick fruit, how much to extract. You know, when I taste fermenting juice today, I know how much we want to extract. I can taste the vintage in each fermenter and decide this is enough, this is too little, we want more. So the interpretation, I think, only comes with time. And you can't have that over a 2 or 3 year period. You need time for that. You grow as a winemaker.
It's, and I'm going to get it wrong, it's a Malcolm Gladwell book called about how you need 10,000 hours to become good at anything. And yeah, just interpreting vintage, that's not about books or, that's just about the amount of, doing it over and over again. Actually, I'm wondering, yeah. Aubrey, how for each vintage, where does the most pressure come in deciding when to pick the grapes? Just as the role of the winemaker, how much stress, or is it now you know it, but I wonder just when you make that decision, what goes into it and how stressful can that be?
I think, talking to an international audience now, South Africa has its own challenges. People just look at the blue skies behind me and we have fantastic weather, but it's harsh conditions. It's challenging in the sense of we have very fast ripening. Your window period of picking is probably 3 to 4 days. That's it. When I work in Germany, you just look for when the rain is coming. Otherwise, the grapes can keep on hanging and you've got a big problem, and you just hope for the maximum amount of sugar. So it's a different challenge in South Africa. So the right picking date is extremely important. And again, when it comes to fruit like Pinotage, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, this is a fruit I mainly work with, Cabernet Franc as well. And it's important to get the picking date right. Otherwise, you're going to either show too much unripe characteristics, or you're not going to get phenolic ripeness, or I think you're going to miss the opportunity to make the best possible wine from that vineyard if you don't get the picking dates right. And I think but that is part of it. That's part of it. Then the interpretation also comes in when you pick. Is there a heat wave on its way? Then if you've missed it on Friday, Monday will be too late. That is a reality in South Africa. And that interpretation carries through all the way through the cellar. How do I handle the grapes from that vintage? So vintages are, although there's a thread carrying through the canonical wines from one vintage to the next, it's not just there because, it's canonical wine. It's also there because you need to make the right decisions.
That is pressure when you have just such a small window of 48 to 72 hours to pick. You're right. That's certainly a higher degree of difficulty than in other parts of the world. You know what? For a moment, let's just talk about today, because yes, this is an international audience. I'm here in Toronto, Ontario. It's February. It's snow. Beyond some winter pruning, not a lot is going on in terms of the viticulture of the Niagara region where I'm close to. But what is today? What is this day like for you, Aubrey, and your cellar and out in the fields?
Oh, so today is a beautiful day out here. A little bit of light breeze blowing. We've had a couple of cooler days. So in degrees Celsius, it's about 30 degrees Celsius in Stellenbosch today, which is actually fantastic growing weather. Now, for us, we want below 35 degrees Celsius and that's probably around 95, 94 Fahrenheit. Yeah. The plant starts to shut down at around 35 degrees Celsius. So you don't get ripeness anymore. It just starts to dehydrate. And so anything below that is for us positive, you know, because the plant carries on to ripen the fruit properly, handle the heat. And yeah, so beautiful growing weather. It's changing, the seasons already slightly changing. So getting dark, getting lighter or slightly later, and also it's quite chilly through the evening, and we get a lot of dew in the morning on the plants, which is not all that positive because that can have a negative, you know, effect on the fungal pressure that we have in the vineyards. So other than that, you know, it's beautiful growing conditions. We are receiving about 80 tons of grapes, and to translate that into bottles, that's about 80,000 bottles of wine, potential bottles of wine that we are receiving today. It's still all Pinotage. We will only start with Merlots next week. And yeah, so it's mainly the older vineyards that we're taking in. So the younger vineyards will ripen earlier, and we're taking in all the top Cadron Corp fruit, all the blocks this week. But the quality is looking exceptional, healthy fruit, proper ripeness, great color. Yeah, I think it's a vintage to look forward to.
Good. All right. People keep that in mind, 2022. Speaking of years, 2008, 2015, 2017, you won the International Wine and Spirits Competition Award for International Winemaker of the Year. And I'm wondering, I imagine you do. Do you remember what the wines were that helped you win those awards?
Yeah, in the beginning, the first time it was the Paul Sauer, I think 2003 vintage. And then the next time it was Pinotage, I think 2012, and Paul Sauer 2009. And then 2017, I can't recall, but I think it was Pinotage again. It was Pinotage, yeah. So they normally take about, you know, the average score of all the wines you enter, and they use that to get you, you know, who wins the prize of the competition.
When you were getting started, even before you took over here, could you thought that there'd be a time where Pinotage would be the grape that would win all this international acclaim? Because there is, I'll be honest, before I came to Stellenbosch, I did not have the highest opinion of Pinotage. And then when I left Stellenbosch, we bought a bunch of your Pinotage. So everything kind of changed within those 2 weeks. But could you have imagined that long ago that Pinotage would be the grape that gets these acclaim?
Well, as a wine lover and people and a person that get excited by quality, yes, you know, it was a matter of time before we would get there. And but it's a you know, international market is a challenging place because there's such a lot of wine out there. And you know, nowadays people try to simplify wine in general. So that means they will learn about a couple of the big countries, and they remember a couple of the big varietals, and they remember a couple of the big producers, and then they know enough to have a good conversation around wine. So the people that only, you know, dig deeper and really wants to become a bit more of a more knowledgeable, they know about Pinotage, they know about the variety and what's going on, but that's not the general public, that's not the general buying public. So it took a while, I think, to get there. And you have to remember this, you know, we've been producing quality Pinotage mainly after 1994. Before that, you know, you can go back to the 60s, even the 59, because the first Pinotage that was produced, you can go back and that wine is still excellent condition. But the focus on Pinotage has only been since 94, after, you know, sanctions were lifted. So it's very, very short period of time compared to other varietals, you know, established varieties through the world. And then also what made it more difficult is the different styles of Pinotage. You know, when you look at something like New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, you know, there's something that connects all those wines with each other. And that makes it so much easier for the drinking public to say, listen, I like New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. Much more difficult to say, I like South African Pinotage. Just because it's so diverse, the country's diverse, the wines are diverse. So it took more time to catch up, but I think people that focus on quality wines throughout the world, you know, they understand, they respect and understand the variety for what it is, for the quality wines it can produce. You know, one of my best experiences I ever had was in Washington, D.C. We had a big dinner at the Congressional Club, and a lot of the people there haven't tried Pinotage before, and The chef prepared deep fried squid heads and wasabi with pinotage. And when I saw the combinations, what is going on? You know, this is going to be a difficult sell by itself. Now we have to add some wasabi to it. And that was the dish of the evening, you know, and people just was in awe how well a red wine can match something like wasabi. So the variety, the style, you know, the structure of the variety, the combinations you can do in restaurants, in kitchens, is so diverse when it comes to pinotage. It just earns respect by just the way it acts on a dinner table or in the glass. So yeah, I always believed in the variety, and I'm very happy that it's finding its space in the wine world today.
It is, and it's based on merit. Some grapes in some countries, you'll get it because you just know it. It's versus with Pinotage, you got to prove it, and you guys certainly have. I'd be curious if you could tell the audience a little bit about the winemaking process at Kennekop. When we went and came and visited you there, it's this really interesting mix of more old school and new school ways of making wine, and they're like right next to each other. It was fascinating just to see to see your cellar.
Oh, it's it also developed over the years from where I started here and where we are today. The big focus is on quality. So if that is your focus, you know, a lot of things fall in place. There's a lot of things that worked over the years. You keep doing. So I always say that the technology and modern equipment doesn't equal quality. So a lot of things in the world is developed to save time, to save space, to save money, to save labor, electricity, and not all of them are adding quality per se. So we still have open top fermenters that we do manual punch downs on half of our fermenting bricks. The other half we've mechanized, but half of it still gets manual punch downs every 2 hours, 24 hours a day, open top ferments, loads of oxygen coming in, but very labor intensive. We need people to get in there with shovels to shovel out the skins. So, but we believe that it does give you a certain style and characteristic that become, an Kennekop style. The technology that we have put in place, is stuff like sorting, optic sorting, mechanical sorting actions. Again, in South Africa, you want to get rid of all the green material because your stems don't ripen in this country. It's not like, or other parts of the world. So we get rid of all the green material by sorting. And then the other thing that we really strongly believe in is proper barrel aging. Again, our style, as you remember, is, it's much bigger. It's not bigger in like it's, dull or clumsy. It's bigger in the sense of getting quite structured wines, but still in an elegant way. And to get to that point, you need proper extraction. Firstly, you need proper grapes, low-yielding vineyards. A lot of irritated. You need proper extraction during fermentation that we do with open-top ferments, and then you need proper barrel aging for the right period of time. So, and at Kennekop, we can do that. We're not pushed for getting to the shelf quickly. We're not pushed to keep up with even if it's a Robert Parker score or stuff like that. We do what we believe in. If we get good ratings or if we, and stuff like that, that's all secondary to what we believe quality should be. And that worked for us over the years in a good way, that we haven't changed our style or just adapted to what the market wants or decides what it should be.
That kind of also answers what just about the general style of your wines, which you sort of answered there, where the idea is about, having this big structured wine, but still having, grace to it as well. But anything else you'd add to just for you stylistically, what do you want the finished product to be like?
I think, we always talk about power with elegance. That's, you can get that type of contradiction with wine already creates a bit of tension that makes you think much more about the product. But saying all of that, one of the most important things when it comes to our style, I want a dry finish on my wine, because that will leave you almost appetized and salivating to have something good to eat with it. So we don't go the sweet route. It must be a dry finish, but appetizing dryness at the end. And that will carry through all our wines. Doesn't matter if it's our second wine or first wine. There's a certain balance to the palate that leaves you, wanting to have a good meal with it.
I was looking at just some news stories, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Kennecott recently bought some more land, the Lady Bird Wine Range, an organic wine farm next door. And I'm wondering if that's true. Just how much impact does that have for you as a winemaker, with sort of this greater source of grapes to play with, to blend with?
Yeah, I think that the investment was made into terroir. That was the main drive for the buy. At this point, we there's four lines of the current ranges that they have that we are carrying on with. And then we will see how it plays out. At the end of the day, this piece of land is to contribute also to Canoncorp and what we are doing already here. And we'll see how that plays out over the next couple of years. I always say we are sustainable. That's our approach to farming and growing grapes. So organic is a different, kettle of fish when it comes to in Stellenbosch specifically, because the pressure of everything around you is quite high. And to get it right is a very fine line and technique. So we'll see how we grow together, the two properties. But at the end of the day, we want to benefit the Canoncorp brand to the maximum. So there's some Merlot growing on that property that is better than what we have at Canoncorp. And that's what you want. You want the sum of the parts to be bigger, and hopefully that's what you can get from that property.
Last question for you. We've talked so much about Pinotage, but the one grape that obviously is so important for your area is Cabernet. And I believe you're on the Stellenbosch Cabernet Collective. And, sort of a simple question, but what makes Stellenbosch, that area, so great for the Cabernet grape?
So when you just take South Africa in general, Stellenbosch is one of the lower yielding areas in South Africa. So that's one of the benefits. It just naturally bears less fruit in our area. And then, of course, I think the ideal climatic conditions, we have hot days and we have cold evenings. And for Cabernet, that's almost a crucial part of quality, is that you have a big difference between day and night. So, for instance, we will have 30 degrees Celsius days now, but it can drop down to 13, 14 degrees at night. And that difference creates more color, more aromatics. And so that's quite beneficial. And I think that is the main thing when it comes to Cabernet. Proper soils. We have deep composed granite soils. We have a couple of mountain ranges around that also gives a unique identity to Cabernet. We have the Helderberg Mountain and Simonsberg Mountain. Both of them gives a different type of expression on Cabernet. And then the climatic conditions, that's just perfect for growing quality Cabernet.
Aubrey, I really appreciate you taking the time. I can tell people that are listening to this in Ontario, Kennecott can be found at the LCBOs and some of the blends that are available. It's ridiculous wine for the quality versus the price point that you're going to get. It's certainly something I learned is just yours is a region that punches over its price point. And congrats just on your journey. I rarely say this, but I'm glad you didn't become a doctor.
Me too.
Aubrey, thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.